Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard D. Wolff, professor of economics and author, who assesses the results of the French presidential election in the context of high unemployment and growing income inequality. Human rights activist and attorney Sahar Francis, who summarizes the demands of Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike, focusing international attention on inhumane conditions in Israeli prisons. And Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive, who discusses provisions in the recently passed GOP House bill to repeal Obamacare and the role of the insurance industry in rescinding the ACA's key benefits. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a six-year search, the United States and Uganda have halted the hunt for murderous warlord Joseph Kony, leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, who is widely condemned for using child soldiers in Africa. Kony is still at large, but soldiers loyal to the Lord's Resistance Army have dwindled in recent years. According to the United Nations, Ugandan troops have withdrawn from a base in the Central African Republic, and 100 U.S. Special Forces have also left. The atrocities committed by Kony and his army gained brief but widespread attention with a 2012 video produced by the group Invisible Children that was viewed by millions. But the focus on Kony quickly moved elsewhere to ethnic conflicts in South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the Central African Republic. The International Criminal Court that is seeking to prosecute Kony for war crimes has issued a $5 million reward for his capture. But human rights groups have criticized the decision to end the hunt to bring Joseph Kony to justice. Holly Dranginis of the U.S.-based Enough Project complained that completely abandoning the mission will create security vacuums for extremely vulnerable communities, particularly in the Central African Republic. The financially troubled Commonwealth of Puerto Rico has filed for protection from its creditors, stating it cannot afford to pay back $70 billion in bonds. The move came a day after groups of bondholders sued the Puerto Rican government for not making payments on its public debt. In a process initiated under last year's congressional bailout law called PROMISA, a board was established to oversee the island's finances, and the Commonwealth has recently filed for a form of bankruptcy. The fate of the island's debt will now be determined by a federal bankruptcy judge. This is the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history, far bigger than the bankruptcy filed by Detroit, Michigan. In the Detroit case, bondholders only recovered 25% of the value of their investment. Talks between the Commonwealth and bondholders, which includes speculative hedge funds, have been deadlocked for months after the government insisted it could not pay its $800 million annual debt, only a quarter of what is owed. Meanwhile, Puerto Rico is mired in a decade-long recession with a 45% poverty rate. Tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans have immigrated to the mainland United States in search of better-paying jobs and financial stability. According to the Christian Science Monitor, several thousand inmates sit in a Chicago jail unable to pay bond. Prison reform advocates say holding people awaiting trial reinforces the cycle of poverty, mass incarceration, and racism in the criminal justice system. Now, activists in Illinois are pushing for legislation to outlaw cash bonds. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox announced that she will be releasing prisoners with a bond of $1,000 or less. Over the last 2 years, there has been a flood of lawsuits challenging the bail system in states including Louisiana, Texas, Georgia, and Tennessee. Last year, the Obama Department of Justice issued a legal brief declaring that issuing a bond without recognition of an individual's ability to pay is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause under the U.S. Constitution. With mounting evidence of the toll that bail is taking on impoverished inmates, there is growing discussion of alternatives. The Vera Institute of Justice released a study of New Orleans concluding that citizens pay out $2 million extra annually to hold inmates who cannot afford bail. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As most polls predicted, the second round of the May 7th French presidential election was won by centrist novice politician and former economy minister Emmanuel Macron, defeating Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right National Front Party, by a margin of 66% to 34%. Macron, a former investment banker, now confronts an economy where 10% of French workers are unemployed, and an environment of rising job insecurity and anger, which attracted a record number of voters to support Le Pen's anti-immigrant and xenophobic platform. While the economy minister under outgoing socialist President François Hollande, Macron was the architect of a 2015 law that reduced worker protections, which provoked widespread labor union protests. Now as president, he's promised to make France more competitive by cutting public sector jobs, reducing government spending, reforming pension laws, and reducing corporate taxes. But the economic policies prescribed by Macron closely follow the edicts of the European Union's so-called Troika, the European Commission, European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, that promote austerity, which in the view of many economists, has led to stagnation and high unemployment. Your reporter spoke with Richard D. Wolff, professor of economics and author, who assesses the results of the French presidential election in the context of high unemployment and growing income inequality.
If you add up all the eligible voters, and the French have a fairly long tradition of having much higher turnouts in their elections than we do, but if you take all of them that were eligible to vote, Mr. Macron, the winner, got 43% of the eligible French voters to vote for him. So he didn't get anywhere near a majority. But if you add to that, as you must, the fact that at least a quarter to a third of the vote he did get was in no way a vote for him, as the people said on their way out of the polls, but a vote against Marine Le Pen, the right-wing, quasi or partly fascist kind of candidate, then Mr. Macron becomes the president of France with a stunningly weak performance, with a stunningly small part of the French population having any enthusiasm or any support for what he represents. And there should be no surprise about this, because he was an economy minister in the previous government of socialist François Hollande, which came into power promising the French working class that it would stop austerity, that it would reverse the policies of the conservative government and build a new economy for France by helping the people in the middle and the bottom, betrayed all of that, became so unpopular that Mr. Hollande could not run for re-election as he had originally planned to do, drove Mr. Macron to be so frightened about the future of a political association with Mr. Hollande that he quit the Socialist Party, set up his own party, and ran this election. This is a sign of a society that is very fast polarizing. And one-third of the votes went for Ms. Le Pen, and she's very clearly based her entire pitch on being France number one, sort of like Trump's America number one, or make America great again. She's viciously anti-immigrant in every way and has been for a long time, scapegoating and blaming immigrants who are not, of course, the cause of the difficulties of French capitalism, to say the least. That's her shtick. Luckily, a large part of France is not willing to do that yet, but they are very dissatisfied with what exists. And having elected Mr. Macron, they have literally put into office a person they have already, in a big majority, said is of no interest and of no importance to them. And on the contrary, they disagree with everything he says and has done for most of his short political career. So this is a highly destabilizing event in French politics and will disrupt and destabilize Europe even more than it already is.
Professor Wolff, I wondered if you'd lay out for us your concern that if the economic and political elites in Europe and the United States don't make some major changes in reversing rising income inequality in the U.S. and Europe, that you're going to inevitably see the rise of the right, as we've already found to be true in the United States and Europe, that at some point they could become a dangerous threat and undermine democratic institutions across the globe.
Well, I think in general, the ruling groups in the United States and Europe are making so much money, which they are, by cashing in on the very problems that they're causing the rest of their citizens, by moving production to low-wage areas so they can make more profits, that they are completely in denial. They are blind. They are doing real well. It's the 1, 2, 3, 4%. They live luxuriously. They have an army of servants of one kind or another to take care of them. They're not going to change what they're doing because they're making out like bandits, which is basically what they are. So I expect nothing to change in that way. Therefore, I expect the instability and the inequality to continue as it has uninterruptedly in the last 25, 40 years. And that means we're going to provoke mass dissatisfaction. I am of the opinion that that could go either to the left or to the right. If the left remains as divided and unclear about where it's going to take society, then it will mostly go to the right, and that's already happening, and that frightens a lot of people, and that's probably a good thing. But it leaves the basic question unresolved, which is, what do you do about an out-of-control capitalism that has no brakes anymore, that doesn't have enough of the people with a broader sense of what's going on, so it is sort of hell-bent on making more money and continuing along the same lines that it has always functioned, and lets the chips fall where they may. Under these circumstances, the left has got to focus itself on becoming the potent force it could be by getting clear where it's going, or else the alternative will be growing turbulence, growing social conflict, and the rise of the right, because the left doesn't offer the mass of disgruntled people a way forward.
That was Richard D. Wolff, visiting professor at New School University's graduate program in international affairs, and author of the book, Capitalism's Crisis Steepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, 2010 to 2014. Find links to more analysis on the French election and EU economic policy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 17th, Palestinian Prisoners' Day, more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails began a hunger strike to protest the severe conditions of incarceration they've suffered and other violations of their human rights. Their demands focus on family visits, medical care, and greatly restricting the use of solitary confinement. An earlier month-long hunger strike by 1,500 Palestinian prisoners in 2012 made similar demands and resulted in some gains, especially in reducing the number of prisoners held by Israel in administrative detention. But the number of prisoners held by Israel has risen again, and one of the key demands of the current hunger strike, led by imprisoned Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti, is opposition to administrative detention. Such detention is based on secret information, where the prisoner has no idea why he or she is being detained. Imprisonment under this status can be renewed indefinitely every 6 months, and some prisoners have been held for years. There are approximately 7,500 Palestinian prisoners being held by Israel today, including women and children under 18 years old. On May 4th, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that the Israel Prison Service, which says 882 prisoners were on hunger strike as of May 9th, must allow the prisoners to meet with their lawyers. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sahar Francis, an attorney and the director of Adamer Prisoners Support and Human Rights Association, based in Ramallah in the West Bank. Here she summarizes the prisoners' demands, which she asserts are in accord with international human rights and humanitarian law.
Mainly the demands are related to the daily life and daily conditions in the prison. So it includes, of course, the health conditions. There's a poor health treatment in the Israeli prison system. Mostly it's based on painkillers. and there's huge delay in implementing medical examinations in order to analyze the problem and to offer proper treatment. Some detainees died in the prison in the last couple of few years out of lack of proper treatment in correct time, like cancer diseases that they were analyzed in like late stage while the detainees were complaining for a long time and they were not taken seriously. Also, the issue of the family visits, it's a very important issue because hundreds of family members are not allowed to visit out of security reasons. There's also the phone calls because all the Palestinian prisoners are not allowed. Even if you are not allowed family visit, you're not allowed to call your family. So actually, there's no contact with your family. It's still around 1,500 people that they are in the hunger strike. But of course, we are not able to visit them as lawyers. This is the most important obstacle we face. It's a grave violation, actually, that the prison system is committing because this is collective punishment for the hunger strikers. And of course, the hunger strike for them is just drinking water because also the prison authority confiscated the salt from their cells. So they are not getting but just the water. Of course, those individuals that their health would deteriorate, some of them were transferred to the hospitals. Most of them, they will refuse to get any medical treatment. With the threatening by the Israeli authorities to use the force feeding, this is also increasing the threat on the life of the prisoners. Now it's according to the Israeli law that the prison authority can use force feeding. Of course, this was objected by the Israeli Medical Association and human rights NGOs. So for us, this would put another threat on the life of the hunger strikers. In the past, in 1981, the Israeli prison authority used force feeding and three detainees died out of the force feeding.
I see that opposition to solitary confinement is another issue. There's a push in the U.S. to reduce the extensive use of solitary in jails and prisons. According to international law, anything more than 15 days is considered torture.
Definitely, yes. This is one of the main demands, actually, to end the policy of solitary confinement as another additional punishment, actually, beside the sentence, the original sentence. And it's used very often and definitely for longer periods, like some people spent around 10 years in solitary confinement under the Israeli prison system. Currently, all the Palestinian prisoners under hunger strike are punished by solitary confinement, so already they are isolated for 3 weeks. As you said, this is a violation for the international law and considered to be torture.
Sahar Francis, what's been the response to the hunger strike, both in Israel and in Palestine?
In the Israeli public in general, there's no support. Of course, you always can find left people that they are aware about the problems of the Palestinian prisoners and about the circumstances. So, of course, there's solidarity, but it's very small. It's coming from individuals and the human rights NGOs, of course. Actually, it is a very important issue for the Palestinian people. It's one of the most essential cases for the future peace process, I think. Without releasing all the Palestinian prisoners, actually, we cannot talk about just and lasting peace.
That was Sahar Francis, an attorney and director of the Atomer Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. Find links to the Atomer website and articles related to the Palestinian hunger strike by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After several failed attempts, President Trump and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives narrowly passed legislation known as the American Health Care Act to repeal and replace President Obama's signature Affordable Care Act. or Obamacare. The measure, which was carried by a 217-213 vote, was rushed through the House on May 4th before the Congressional Budget Office could score the bill to assess its cost and impact on national health care. But a previous CBO evaluation on a less severe version of the bill found that at least 24 million Americans would lose their health insurance coverage if the AHCA were ever to be signed into law. Negotiations with the GOP's right-wing House Freedom Caucus faction secured sufficient votes for passage, but their members extracted concessions that undoubtedly will make the bill even less popular than the previously debated version. Key provisions in the bill that passed include the loss of protections for those with pre-existing conditions, mandated employer insurance plans are now jeopardized, Medicaid expansion has ended with an $800 billion budget cut, Planned Parenthood is defunded, and the wealthiest Americans receive a $765 billion tax cut over the next decade. The AHCA bill now moves to the U.S. Senate, where many Republicans openly criticize the measure and say they'll draft new reform legislation from scratch, which then must be sent back to the House. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and whistleblower. Here he assesses provisions in the GOP House bill, prospects for action in the U.S. Senate, and the role of the insurance industry in eroding key benefits in the Affordable Care Act.
It is awful, awful legislation. It is about some of the worst I've ever seen. And it is something that would take us back to what life was like for many people before the Affordable Care Act was passed. In fact, make it worse. It's estimated that at least 25 million people would lose their health insurance. Just as bad, a lot of people who have pre-existing conditions, and quite frankly, that is almost a majority of us these days, would face higher premiums, and some cases wouldn't be able to afford coverage at all. It would allow insurance companies essentially to do what they used to do, which is declare some people uninsurable, blackball them, and not enable people to get not only the insurance they need, but access to care that they need. In so many ways, it would put the insurance industry much more in the driver's seat once again of our healthcare system than they already are, and would let them engage in some of the most egregious practices that needed to end.
Wendell, the insurance industry in the United States helped write the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and they reaped a lot of profits because of the expanded pool of customers for their insurance,
yep,
with the subsidies that came in line and all that. What was the role, as you understand it, of the insurance industry in working with Republicans on this piece of legislation that has passed the House of Representatives but is not law yet? It still needs to go through the Senate and back to the House. There's a whole long process ahead.
You're exactly right. The insurance companies have done very, very well since the Affordable Care Act went into effect. They've reaped, they've been reporting record profits. So they've done well. What they don't like is that they can't engage in some of these practices that they once did. They think there's a chance they might even be more profitable if they got rid of some of these restrictions on them. They would like to go back to the time when they could pick and choose who to insure, so that they could weed out people who really need coverage. And undoubtedly, they're working behind the scenes to help lawmakers message, if you will, what they're trying to do here in ways that they think can be sold to the American public. But they're asking them to sell. They're selling a bill of goods. On the other hand, the insurance companies don't like that the Republicans would change the Medicaid program to what's essentially referred to as a block grant program. In other words, the federal government would just provide a certain amount of money to the states. The effect would be to reduce the Medicaid payments almost $1 trillion over the next several years. Insurance companies don't like that because many states have largely turned over their Medicaid programs to insurance companies. So insurance companies would see a significant decline in revenues if that part of the bill goes through.
There are many listeners who have heard about a universal single-payer health care bill that's going through the California legislature. And I'm wondering if you think there's a chance that we could see an example of universal health care in one of our largest states, California, that could be an example for the federal system, much in the way that Saskatchewan, a province in Canada, was the first to adopt a universal single-payer system in that country, in Canada, and was later adopted by the federal government in Ottawa.
I think it's entirely possible, and there is strong support for single-payer health care in California, and also in Oregon and Washington, too, and other states. But California would be especially significant if it were to pass a single-payer bill. There is a bill that is before the California legislature now that has been introduced that would create a single-payer system. It may not get approved this year, but there is strong support for it, growing support for it. And I think what you're going to see is that business leaders are going to wake up and start embracing this. And business leaders in particular are I think, waking up to understanding that our multi-payer system in which we have all these insurance companies that really cannot control cost and that add cost to the system, it just doesn't make sense for them or the country. Healthcare for those employers that provide coverage, it's an expense that they can't predict year after year. And like I said, insurance companies are showing, demonstrating that they cannot control healthcare costs. And I think the gig is up for them, or will be, in a few years, because employers who are very politically active, I think, may be ultimately the death knell for the system that we have now.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and best-selling author of Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. Learn more about opposition to the Republican Repeal and Replace Healthcare Bill by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in East Orland, Maine, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.